I'm Ken Hemmings, and he is Chris Lang, and welcome to another of these regular property briefings. Again, a warm welcome to you, Chris.
Thanks, Ken. And would you like to keep talking about the book?
Yes. Before we started today, you mentioned a book you'd recently read about the property collapse in Ireland following the GFC. So perhaps you could continue with that for the benefit of our listeners.
Okay. Well, the book is called Breakfast with Anglo, and that's Anglo-Irish Bank. And it's written by Simon Kelly, who was arguably probably the leading developer in Ireland leading up to the global financial crash. And it recounts his escapades, for want of a better word, and the ins and outs of various deals that he did in the probably 6 or 7 or 8 years of this century, from 2000 to about 2008.
From what you said earlier, Simon Kelly actually summarised a number of key lessons to be learned as a result of what occurred. So what were some of them?
Yeah, look, he did summarise quite a few lessons he gained from the experience. And I recently did a webinar for my mentor clients, which went into this in some length. But what I'll try and do is cover the key ones now. The first point was that property is just like any other asset. There's nothing magic about it. It's going to rise and fall in value. And however, it is less liquid, and therefore your cycles tend to be longer. But that can also mean your booms and busts can be a little bit more dramatic. Now, fortunately, commercial property is driven by the availability of credit and the supply of specific properties. So really, if you want to adopt a buy and forget strategy, you need to ensure that you've got solid tenants and that your leases will comfortably straddle any downturn that might be coming in the future. Now, preferably, you'll adopt a modified buy and trade approach where you undertake a mandatory 4-year review, which we've discussed in the past. And therefore, the day that you buy the property is, you ought to think about it as the day you sell it. In other words, you already need to have an exit strategy in place so that you can move quickly if the need arises. Now, obviously, the easiest properties to sell will be in and around capital cities. But you know, you don't want to be seduced by attractive yields offered by what I call peripheral properties, because they're going to be harder to sell in tougher times. When I say peripheral, it might be in geography, it might be in the standard of property. And it's for that reason that you appear to get initial higher income yields because they're needed to get the property sold. So also avoid development and speculative deals because they will involve you in precise estimates for your exit timeline. And in other words, if you don't meet them because they're fixed timelines, because you can't stop halfway through, you've got to finish the development. So overall, the secret is to seek out passive investments with solid, predictable rental income.
Obviously, borrowing would have played a major role.
Well, yeah, it is. And there are a couple of lessons there. Probably the first question to ask is leverage. Is it your friend or your foe? At the end of any cycle, your ideal position is to be holding unleveraged properties as investments. And that may entail some strategic sales at your four-year review. So, in other words, during an upswing, you use your leverage or borrowing wisely by effectively setting up non-recourse loans. And that's where you don't sign any personal guarantees. The sole security is the property itself. And okay, you might be able to borrow 65%, but that's prudent anyway. And you get your main deductions, apart from the interest component, through depreciation. So the idea being that you would start to weed out and sell your most easily sold properties before you actually reach the peak, so that you don't get caught with the banks. And that brings us to the next one, that, you know, never trust your bank. I mean, some people say, look, I've had the relationship for years, they'll always look after me. Look, it's not going to happen, you know. And you may genuinely believe that you are, particularly if you're a private banking client, have a privileged position as far as the bank's concerned. However, as he found out, because he had a very close relationship with Anglo, that when the market declines, the credit committee will always overrule the director of private banking. And when credit gets tight and the banks stop lending, everyone suffers, you know, private banking clients included. So hence the suggestion to avoid personal guarantees and to only raise funds on a non-recourse basis.
I think you also mentioned that Kelly covered something about focus.
Yeah, it was interesting the way he approached that. He said that where you live ought to be based on emotion and lifestyle, but where you actually invest should be governed by good opportunities, predictable income, and solid growth. So it doesn't mean spread yourself far and wide. It means go to where the best deals are. Now, they may be across the street, but equally they may be on the other side of the country. I mean, it's interesting that 80% of my clients at the moment come from interstate and want to buy their properties in Melbourne. I mean, the Brisbane and Perth and Adelaide office markets, for example, are in double-digit vacancy rates. I mean, I think Adelaide's just hit 15. Brisbane's heading up that way. Perth's not there yet, but it, by next year, probably will be pretty close to it. Whereas Melbourne and Sydney are under 10, closer to around about 8. So, and the market, to be in balance, needs to have about a 6 to 8% vacancy rate so that there can be legitimate movement around the marketplace as people grow and expand and contract. So, as such, what you need to do is uncover and invest in the most rewarding markets, wherever they may be in Australia. And once you have a good team of consultants in place, geography is no longer your sole determinant of where you invest. So in other words, you don't have to draw a 20-minute ring around your home and say, look, I can't invest anywhere past that, because it's the key team of consultants that not only multiply your time, but multiply your skills and the ability to tap into wider markets. And that brings us to his next point, and that is that you want to invest more money into fewer projects. In other words, don't allow yourself to be spread too thin. You know, you need to remain an investor, not simply a property accumulator. Some people just buy properties because they've got the money for the sake of buying the properties. You only want to invest in properties for which you feel you have a passion for. Now, that doesn't mean you have to fall in love with the property, because in that negotiating training, I say, look, once you have to have the property, you're going to pay too much. You always need to be able to walk away from it, but you have to be excited by it. And I say to clients, look, it doesn't matter how good a property I say it is, if for whatever reason you don't feel comfortable, I'm not going to let you buy the property, because the two happiest days will be the day you buy it and the day you sell it. You know, because, I mean, you'll buy it because I say it's a good property, but all the way along, you just don't have a good feeling about it. So you want to be buying properties that gets you excited, not to the point of ecstatic frenzy, but that you really feel good about it. You feel comfortable. You could put your friends in the car on the weekend and drive to the property if it's nearby, or fly there, and you would feel proud telling them that you own the property. That's the feeling you have to have about it. Yes, it has to make sense economically, but you need to feel good about it as well. So, as I said, more money into fewer projects so that you don't have this myriad of properties that create, not only for you but for your consultants, a nightmare for ongoing management.
What sort of advice did he give about property bubbles?
Well, obviously, watch out for bubbles. Of course, they will continue to occur going forward as they have in the past. And the secret is in knowing where you are in the particular cycle. And we've spent mentioned a number of podcasts in the past that, you know, the office cycle being the longest one is likely to peak around 2019-2020, in that order. Now, I remember going back to when the last peak occurred, you get into a taxi and the taxi driver is talking about how good the market is and where to invest. That's when you know it's the time to start planning your strategic exit. This is when you start, we talked before, weeding out your probably least saleable properties, but in a rising market, you will always find a buyer for them. You might have to offer a slightly higher yield, but you will get the property away, sold, you'll make a handsome profit on it, and you get those sort of properties away to lower your debt ratio so that you then can enter any downturn not heavily geared at all. So you may end up selling 6 or 9 months before the peak. I mean, you'll never know. But you never also want to try to precisely gauge the top of the market. It's just not possible. It's the same way trying to gauge the bottom of the market. It's better to buy just before the bottom, might flatline for a while, and then go up. As soon as the market increases, you have to compete. You'll end up paying more than you have to. Likewise, if the market starts to turn, it's always difficult to sell into a falling market with property, commercial property, or residential for that matter. With shares, it's not so much of an issue. You can always sell shares. It's just a matter of dropping your price. But once the market turns, people tend to want to wait to see how far it's falling before they actually buy the property. So you just got to be mindful of where you are in the present cycle. And then the final point, perhaps, is that you always need to have a plan B. Now, I mean, plan A is always the best and most exciting outcome, the most profitable for you. Everything goes perfectly, swimmingly, from the day you buy it to the day you sell it. Unfortunately, most people enter the future looking backwards. What's happened in the past, they assume will continue on. Now, if it's in a rising market, they will believe it will continue on to rise and rise and rise. Conversely, when the market is declining, everyone's doom and gloom. They just can't see an end to it. It will end, both in the decline and also the rise. And what you need to do is anticipate and try and, as best you can, with the advice you can muster, anticipate when that change is going to occur. It's inevitable it will, but you need to arrive at a best estimate. And therefore, what you need to do is have a backup plan to at least return your initial equity that you invested in the deal. And so, as I said, the secret is to have your properties ranked. I mean, not all properties are going to be the best. You will sometimes buy a rundown property that short leases that over a 3 or 4 year period you have upgraded the property, changed the use, increased the rental and therefore the value. And so what started out as a say, we'll call it a third tier property, now is a first tier property. It's actually passed others that were bought with a good passive income, but not as much upside. So the status of your properties will alter. And so as you reach the top of a cycle, you have your properties ranked, and it's the ones at the bottom of the list. And there may be nothing wrong with them, but they, just by virtue of what's happened with the rest of your portfolio, they become the least attractive and therefore maybe the harder to sell. And so those are the ones that you pair off, use the money to pay down loans on the other ones, so that when you go into a downturn, at worst, you're going in with a 50% gearing, ideally better than that or lower than that, so that as and when opportunities arise, when the market turns and the values have fallen, you will still be able to purchase good properties at discount prices. Nothing wrong with them physically, nothing wrong with them as far as the tenancy is concerned. It's just that the vendor has overcommitted and held on too long, and they just physically cannot continue to own the property. And in those circumstances, whoever has the access to cash will be able to snare some real bargains. And I'm not talking doom and gloom. I'm just helping you. The time to have this discussion is when the market is rising and you can do some forward thinking, forward planning, so that around 2017, 2018, you start to review your whole portfolio so that you can, at a time of your choosing, realise at a profit by selling certain properties within your portfolio, so that you end up with the gems going into any downturn where the leases straddle the downturn, and you can continue to hold them comfortably without an exposure or a fear that the banks are going to challenge you or cause you to have to do any forced sales. And that's what Simon Kelly was. The problem is that they were just overexposed, and that's the whole story that in his book. And it's a fascinating read. It really is well written, in the sense that you feel you're there, you feel you're part of it, and there are some salutary lessons that can be learned for every investor from the book.
Well, that all sounds pretty sensible advice.
Yeah, it is. And if you go back through some of our previous podcasts, I think you'll find that we've probably covered most of this already in some form or another.
Yet, unlike Simon Kelly, you've also had to weather the 1989 property crash. So I guess that allows you to provide our listeners with a rather well-balanced view of things. So thank you for bringing all those insights together.
Once again, I just hope it was helpful.